Hello, my name is Susanna Vance Gopalan. I practice in the healthcare field at Feldman Tucker Leifer Feigl in Washington, D.C. And I'm a member of the Post-Acute and Long-Term Services Practice Group at AHLA. Lately, the practice group has been focused on how we can quickly get information out to AHLA's membership to support long-term care providers who are on the front lines of the fight against the coronavirus pandemic, trying to protect their residents and keep their operations going. We're really glad you're listening to our podcast today entitled Strings Attached, How Long-Term Care Facilities Can Be Compliant in Using Funds Under the COVID-19 Provider Relief Fund. Most long-term care facilities have received money under one or more of the Provider Relief Fund programs, and we plan to talk today about what this is, how the federal government has distributed the funds, and most importantly, what the providers need to know about documenting their use of the funds and complying with reporting and auditing requirements. Before we start our discussion today, I wanted to thank AHLA for hosting this podcast, and I particularly want to thank our experts, Harvey Tettelbaum of the law firm Hush Blackwell in Jefferson City, Missouri, and Camille Lockhart of the accounting and advisory firm BKD. Harvey is a member with me of AHLA's PALS practice group. He has 50 years of health law experience across the entire healthcare spectrum, from primary care to acute and post-acute care. And he works extensively with long-term care facilities on issues relating to their response to COVID-19. I understand he's been doing this with Camille Lockhart, who advises long-term care providers and more on the accounting and advisory side. She at BKD provides audit and consulting services to long-term care facilities and also home health and hospice agencies. Her experience includes leading audit teams for long-term care providers, and she also advises on Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement matters. Camille and Harvey, thank you both so much for participating in the podcast today.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
So shall we get right into it?
Sure.
So, Harvey, I wanted to ask you for the broad outlook right now. Recognizing this requires some generalizations, given what a diverse sector this is, what do you see as the most significant COVID-related financial impacts on the long-term care sector right now?
Well, I think they're short-term and long-term impacts. The short-term, I think, are staffing and census. There's been a tremendous loss of Medicare revenue because of the absence of elective surgeries, which were done on parts of the body that required physical rehabilitation in long-term care facilities, and that's reimbursed by Medicare, so that prevented facilities from having that revenue stream. And of course, with the COVID pandemic, there's been exacerbated what had prior to that actually been a staffing shortage for facilities in most parts of the United States, because persons are reluctant to come and work at long-term care facilities because they hear about the concentration of infection at long-term care facilities. The long-term aspects, I think, are being able to figure out if you're going to be able to actually benefit from the money that the Congress has appropriated, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes, and what actions are needed in order to be able to keep the money that you actually have received. And again, we'll cover a little bit of that, I think, in our podcast later on.
Great. And recognizing this is a bit of a tangent from our main topic, I'm curious what you're seeing about how the facilities are responding to the staffing shortages right now.
Well, there are a number of ways they're responding. They are increasing the compensation. They're giving bonuses. There are some efforts in some states going on to create arrangements with hospitals, which have actually been laying off people because of the absence of elective surgeries, and to see whether there could be arrangements where those employees could be leased to long-term care facilities. We've been working on some of that in our state, trying to get arrangements like that done. So I think those are some of the ways that facilities have been dealing with these staffing shortages.
And I'll add to that, Susanna, that there's some states too that are pushing money to facilities directly to the employees, where a lot of this money that we're going to talk about today goes directly to the providers. There are some states that are getting it straight to the employees for that hazard/incentive retention type of funding.
Oh, right, through Medicaid emergency state plan amendments, for example, where the
yes,
interesting. Well, moving our focus to the emergency funding sources. So as we're all aware, Congress has enacted several COVID stimulus packages, and HHS has issued a lot of guidance and rulemakings affecting almost every aspect of how providers are responding to this crisis. Camille, what of the new initiatives and funding streams do you think are most helping long-term care facilities right now?
Well, I think you could, if you want to look at it from an administrative perspective, while we're not discussing the PPP loans, initially it was the PPP loans. This was the easiest money to get, and administratively the easiest to be able to keep. But, you know, now that we've seen the healthcare provider relief funds coming through HHS, you know, these three different tranches, if you will, or deposits that people have seen, most people in the senior living business saw all three. You know, those funds, you didn't have to go through an application to get it like you did with the PPP loan. They just got deposited in your account. And of course, what we're here today to talk about is how that happened and how do you work to justify keeping it.
Right. Yes. And moving to the legal underpinnings of this, as we are mostly lawyers, we're addressing here, and 2/3 lawyers in this present conversation. Let's talk about the provisions, the statutory provisions that created the Provider Relief Fund. I understand the authorization comes for the initial Provider Relief Fund amounts enacted in March comes from the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, which is referred to as the CARES Act. Harvey, how much was appropriated under this law for the Provider Relief Fund?
There was $100 billion appropriated under the CARES Act. There's the Public Health and Social Services Emergency Fund, $70 billion of that has been sent, and that $50 billion of general distributions was distributed. So let me break this down. There was $30 billion distributed starting April 10th, and the money hit people's providers' accounts at various different times, but it started April 10th. And then there was $20 billion distributed starting April 24th. And then subsequently and more recently, $4.9 billion was distributed on May 24th to long-term care facilities participating in the Medicare program. If you are a Medicaid-only long-term care facility, you did not receive any of that money. The other amounts include targeted distributions, $12 billion for COVID hotspots, $10 billion for rural hospitals, and $50 million for Indian Health Service. And the remaining $22.5 billion will be allocated based on uninsured treatment of COVID patients. And there's an additional $75 billion to be allocated as the government sees fit.
Great. And did I understand from what Camille said that for the majority of these distributions, there is no application needed? The funds have simply been dropped into the provider's account?
That's correct, but there are attestations that have to be made. There are terms and conditions which apply to all of these funds that must be complied with. These terms and conditions have been changing from tranche to tranche of money,
right.
So as well as the attestation. So it's something you have to pay attention to. It's not just if you have your money, you can keep it. You have to comply with the rules.
Right. Seems like a nice problem to have, to see hundreds of thousands of dollars drop into your account and not have had to apply for it, but it can also be a bit of a maze, I gather, to understand what terms are associated with which disbursement that the provider receives.
That's correct.
So, Harvey, you mentioned a general distribution of $50 billion, I think you said. On what basis did HHS award money to providers under that general distribution?
It was awarded based upon your Medicare billings, and that was the reason why much more money went to hospitals than went to long-term care facilities. Then there were there were additional funds that were based upon other factors, but the initial money was based upon your the amount of money that you were paid by Medicare.
Got it. And I this was a part of the whole thing I found somewhat confusing. There was the initial $30 billion tranche, which is part of this $50 billion general distribution, that was based on the Medicare fee-for-service billings in 2019. And then I gathered the remaining 20 was based on what they called net patient service revenues.
Correct.
I confess I don't really understand what that amounted to, and if it was meaningfully different standard.
I think really what they were doing from that perspective, when the first tranche got paid, it was based on Medicare receipts, and they knew that these providers weren't all just providing services to Medicare, and that there are providers out there that have a larger population of non-Medicare of patients that they take care of. And so on that second tranche, what they did is they went to the one thing that they did have access to, and that was total revenues of a provider. And they can get that off of the Medicare cost report on Schedule G3, which is basically the starting point of the income statement, if you will, within the cost report. And so there's a line in there that shows what net patient service revenue is. And so what they did is they looked at that number, did a calculation, which was basically about 2%, saying we're going to pay out, we're going to use of these provider relief funds, we're going to use 2% of their net patient, give them 2% of their net patient service revenue. But then we'll subtract whatever that calculates to be, we'll subtract what came in the first tranche.
And I see. Okay.
It was the concept that was being used there.
Great. And this is all SNFs, skilled nursing facilities, of course, have cost reports, but for providers who don't have cost reports, I wonder how they handled that.
Well, most of this has been all based on Medicare. The original tranche was based on Medicare fee-for-service payment. So, I mean, most of those people will be providing, or will be, they have to prepare cost reports.
Right, right. And do you have a sense of what portion of these funds went to long-term care facilities from the general distribution as opposed to hospitals and other provider types?
Yeah, really relatively very little. Most went to the hospitals for the reason I previously stated. The $4.9 billion distribution was targeted directly, again, to those facilities participating in Medicare. So if you were not participating in Medicare, if you were a Medicaid-only facility, as I said, you did not receive any of that $4.9 billion. And you the way it was distributed was $50,000 for each facility plus $2,500 per skilled bed.
I see. For Medicare skilled beds.
For Medicare facilities, right.
Right. And Camille, I understand each of these payment streams under the Provider Relief Fund has its own terms and conditions. And some of them are rooted in the actual statutory provision in CARES, but a lot of them do not seem to be. What do you think for long-term care providers are some of the most important terms and conditions to take note of under the general distribution funds that came out first?
Well, I think when you dig down into them and you compare them side by side, big elephant in the room is really, okay, how do we keep this? How do we demonstrate that, you know, we did need it? And those terms and conditions across the board and on all three tranches specifically say that the funds are to be used on expenses related to preventing, preparing, and responding to COVID, and can be used on lost revenues related to COVID. That is consistent across all three tranches, terms and conditions. And then, just as important is that they have to follow an outlined prescription of maintaining those records and documentation as described by the OMB. And that's, you know, something a lot of these providers have not been accustomed to because they've not necessarily received, we use this term a little loosely, but grant money. And mm-hmm. when you have to follow those types of record keeping and documentation. But those are the two most critical pieces, is that you spend it on preventing, preparing, and responding for COVID and to subsidize those lost revenues related to COVID, and that you document how you did that, what those expenses were for, and creating those records and documentation policies that are described by OMB. I think it's very important that people pay very close attention to that.
Right. And the purpose of the expenditures, as you described it, and I think it appears in the law itself. I mean, it seems super broad, preventing, responding to the disease, or also covering lost revenues. What's an example of a type of expense a long-term care facility would incur that would not be an acceptable use of these funds? And how are you recommending, given the breadth of the standards, that that providers think about what is allowable to use the money for?
Okay, I might not answer this question exactly the way you asked it, but let me kind of just explain what we're advising clients to do, because it is not, you know, they've not identified what the true definition of those expenses are, except for these very broad terms. And
right.
They do not define lost revenues as well. However, they in the FAQs, they do address some examples of how you could calculate lost revenues. I'll just kind of talk to that for just a moment. With respect to the lost revenues, the FAQs addressed a couple examples. One of them was looking at the March and April, your March and April revenues, and comparing it to your budgeted revenues for that time to determine a lost revenue amount. I thought that was a pretty loose definition, because who's to say what the budget was? And you've got looking at actual March and April 2020 and comparing it to actual March and April 2019. That seems a little logical to me, but there are a lot of things that can make those numbers not necessarily be apples to apples. And so another way one could look at it is look at your average resident per day, because while your census might not have changed overall, Harvey talked about, you know, the ceasing all elective surgeries. So your Medicare population in your facility for for many, many of our clients has just plummeted. And really that Medicare volume is really what supports so much of the operations because of other underfunding with Medicaid. And so I think it's important to look at your average resident per day by payer class. So if you were to look at March and April of 2020, and you only have two Medicare residents, where you might normally average the 2 months prior or those same 2 months a year ago, 10 residents, you take that times an average length of stay times your average Medicare rate, you know, you can get there pretty quick on the kind of revenues you're losing because of the ceasing of those elective surgeries. So that's an example on lost revenues.
Right. And it's a more granular or targeted way of looking at that concept than the suggestions they provided in the FAQs, it sounds like.
Right. And just a couple of things with related to, you asked about examples of expenses. You know, they use it broadly where they say prevent, prepare, and respond. And then they do not address in terms of additional expenses. They just say related to preventing, preparing, and responding. But when you really look at your operations, I mean, you think about how people's normal daily activity, employees' normal daily activity within a facility changed drastically and went from what they would normally do just taking care of the residents to this, you know, basically a covert operation to
really
everyone safe. Those activities they're doing are preventing and preparing for it. So we are recommending that clients continue, you know, start tracking that going back to March and tracking that. But at the same time, you know, looking at your card costs, just your normal purchasing that you had to do, the food costs you had to take on in feeding employees in house, how much a lot of these products cost more because you can't. And so you want to look at that price differential as well. So there are a lot of examples out there. We actually have a great place on our website that gives a lot of those different ideas to think about.
Great, on your BKD website.
Yes.
And I wanted to note too that when Camille refers to the FAQ, I don't see a good other way to identify the link except that when you Google CARES Act Provider Relief Fund Frequently Asked Questions, you'll come upon this huge FAQ document that appears to be being updated quite regularly regarding the various distributions of the Provider Relief Fund. So there are really a lot of issues that are addressed pretty helpfully in there.
And Suzanne, I want to real quick, when you go to the website itself and you go to the CARES Act, learn more, and it takes you to the different portals. When you kind of scroll down on that page where you see the different portals, there is a link down there to the FAQs also.
Great, the HHS Provider Relief Fund website.
Yes.
And that is, I have to say, it's pretty well structured in that it just describes each allocation separately, has a separate link to the terms and conditions for each. So it does give a pretty good sense of how the whole program is structured.
I was going to say, excuse me for interrupting, I was going to say that each of the associations, trade associations for the various provider groups have really done a pretty good job as well. So if you're a long-term care provider and you're a member of the American Healthcare Association, for example, or Leading Age, you can go to their websites and they have a lot of very useful material that gets into some of the detail that Camille was talking about.
Great point. Thanks. And Harvey, I wanted to come back to you mentioned the almost $5 billion targeted funding for the skilled nursing facilities that participate in Medicare. Camille, you're talking about just the general most important terms and uses of funds. Is there anything more specific or different about that $5 billion that's just being distributed to the SNFs that we need to know in terms of how the money can be used or other limitations?
No, it's pretty much the same as the first two tranches. Again, you're supposed to be using this money to prevent, prepare, and respond to COVID. And same way that Camille was talking about just a few minutes ago, and what the lost revenue is that you can calculate. So the terms and conditions, it seems to us, are pretty much the same, although, again, we suggest that with each of these tranches that you look at the terms and conditions that apply to each, because they sometimes can be a little bit different. And also look at the frequently asked questions that apply to them. And I might also add that HHS has a phone line that you can call as a provider and ask questions, although we are finding that if you do that, sometimes you may want to ask your question more than once because you may get different answers from different people, which is
right.
not necessarily that unusual, but they're very nice and they're very helpful. And so it can give you some idea of kind of what the ballpark is for your particular question.
Right. I guess it's kind of like with Medicare, you know, you can call the MAC and you might get this delightful answer to your question, but.
Right. Or the IRS or, you know, any of the agencies, you know, everybody has, the Congress created these programs so quickly and the time frames to implement them were so short that it's been quite a, actually, CMS, I think, HHS, SBA, they've all really, I think, done a good job of getting the money out and trying to inform people later on so that folks can have the benefit of the money to be able to deal with the situation as it was arising.
Yeah, I agree with you. I work quite a bit in the telehealth space, and it is it's kind of bewildering all the stages of rulemaking and guidances that CMS has issued. But really, when you think how burdensome the federal government processes are, they have acted with quite a bit of agility here in this fast-moving crisis. I wanted to ask you both, we've talked about these various funding streams. Should providers and their counsel think of these as a grant or some other form of payment? And if it is a grant, what is the significance of that?
Well, you know, they do not. I mean, when you look at the terms and conditions and most everything, you don't necessarily see the term grant, but if you do, you can work your way to it within HHS website and the general distribution portal. When you go to the user guide, if you're using the general distribution portal to apply for additional monies, the user guide does reference on the very first page that this is a grant. And you know, with respect to considering it that, I mean, their intent is not to take it back. I mean, they want people to have these funds to provide the relief of the expenditures they're using to address COVID and to subsidize their lost revenues. But as we've said, and we'll continue to say through the rest of this podcast, that they have to follow those terms and conditions. And now the other thing that can meet connects it to that grant world, if you will, is that subsequently these funds have been assigned a CFDA number.
Right.
Just for reference, in case someone wants it, is 93.498. So, you know, HRSA has assigned it a CFDA number that is demonstrating that it is subject to the OMB guidance, and it will be subject to a single audit if you exceed $750,000 in funds.
Interesting. And can you tell me a little more about what a single audit is and what that entails?
Well, normally only nonprofits it's only been a part of their world. They receive some type of a grant money that requires them to If they exceed a threshold, then they are required to have an audit by an independent auditor come in and audit that program to make sure that they have agreed to the terms and conditions. Now, the specific guidance that's been given in those terms and conditions related to, so OMB basically will line out these specific guidelines that you follow. Well, HHS has only identified just less than half a dozen of the different guidance from OMB that has to be followed, which is unusual. And so we're really kind of at a loss right now exactly how we do that, but those conversations are taking place with HHS and HRSA, and we had a partner just this morning that was involved in those conversations. So it is an independent audit process that you have to go through. It's separate from, you know, HHS isn't doing it, the OIG isn't doing it. It is specifically the provider is hiring an independent accountant to do it. And
right.
And normally this has only been, this only applies to nonprofits, but it does seem like they will be applying this to for-profits, and but those, that guidance has not been given yet.
Interesting, and not necessarily all of the grant requirements in the federal regulations will apply to these audits, it sounds like.
Correct. It's interesting.
And for those that are not familiar with the acronyms, HRSA is the Health Resources and Services Administration, which is an agency of the Department of Health and Human Services.
Thank you, Harvey. And that's also, HRSA, I believe, is essentially administering the Provider Relief Fund disbursements. Is that right? Or many of them?
Yes.
Yes, it is an agency of HHS.
And Camille, I thought it was interesting, not to go too far down this rabbit hole, but I read the CFDA announcement after you alerted me to it, and I noticed that even the Uninsured Services Claims Program is included within that announcement, which is, was interesting to me because that portion of the Provider Relief Fund is not, you wouldn't think of that as resembling a grant at all, in that providers, you know, file claims for services that they have provided to uninsured individuals. So I would think that would be interesting for the auditors to keep track of.
Well, give it another week or two. Give it another week or two. That might change.
Okay.
You know, Harvey and I were laughing. You know, today's Friday. Friday always,
right.
Something always happened every Friday.
Right. Something good to mess up your Saturday afternoon with. Questions to answer about it. So I know there's not an actual application process for this, even though interestingly I noted that the law does mention an application, but it seems that instead providers simply have the funds credited to their account. How is HHS getting around this? How are they making sure that providers understand the terms and conditions, and what do the providers have to do to indicate that understanding?
Well, I do think that it has been confusing because they have used this whole application wording throughout different parts of verbiage on the website. But, you know, yes, the money's got deposited, but the general distribution, you have your attestation portal, and I'm kind of answering the first part of your question. So You have the attestation portal, and might I mention that that's been extended to 90 days from data receipt that you have to attest. But they had originally created the general distribution portal to be utilized as an application process, that if you felt you weren't paid enough and you wanted to, or your lost revenues did not substantiate, or the funds didn't substantially help you recover those lost revenues, you could go to this general distribution portal and apply for additional money. And so that's really, I think, kind of where this application verbiage came into play. But, and there is some, I'll just go ahead and say this now, that you didn't ask this, but technically due June 3rd is the last date that you can apply for more money, at least as of today, through the general distribution portal. And part of that application process is uploading your financial tax return information and then putting in your lost revenues from March and April. Well, those two items are also required just regardless for any provider receiving any of these general distribution funds.
Right.
But this July 3rd date is, when you read it on the website, it's if you want more money. But because they have extended your attestation period to 90 days, if you're not wanting more money, it would just go to say that if attestation has been extended 90 days, you don't have to upload your financial information until you attest, because you can't even use the general distribution portal until you do your attestation. So I probably got off track from your actual question, but I wanted to get that in there.
Right. Yeah. No, that's really interesting. It sounds like it could be pretty bewildering. So if the providers got money back before the attestation period was extended, it was 45 days before, right?
Well, it was originally, then it went 45, and now it's at 90.
Uh-huh. Okay. But whatever deadline they got in the first instance applies, I assume, right? It's not that the deadline hasn't been extended retrospectively, or has it?
I'm sorry, can you ask that question again? I'm not quite sure I understood.
Oh, I guess it was like if you received an amount on, you know, April the 5th, and it said you have to complete your attestation within 30 days or whatever the time frame was at the time. When they've adjusted these time frames, does that extend the provider's deadlines to finish the attestation retrospectively,
or does it? And upload their financial information. You would think that it would. They have not clarified that, but you would think they still have that 90-day period to get their financial information uploaded into the general distribution portal.
Right, I see. And do you encounter any examples of providers who, conversely to asking for more money, have found they have amounts credited to their accounts that seem in excess of what the formula would indicate? And how do you advise them?
Yes, there are some people who received more than they should have. We first originally would have them, you know, call the 1-800 number, but I have not dealt specifically with a client that sent a partial amount back. But some people have definitely received too much or received it and shouldn't have. There are all different kinds of scenarios. And there's a lot of answers we still don't have. They're still being vetted out.
Yeah, it seems that if you receive more money than you should have according to the formula, then what we're hearing when we've inquired on behalf of our clients is to determine whether you anticipate that you're going to continue to have expenses that will allow you to utilize that money. And if you do anticipate that, then you can keep the money during that period of time. Of course, when it's all said and done, if at the end of the period you have not been able to expend all that money, then as Camille indicated, then you should return that money. It becomes a quote overpayment unquote, and you have 60 days to return it.
Interesting. Right. So they should probably make the inquiry before going into the attestation portal so that they can get straight this issue.
And speaking of miscalculations, you know, the OIG did announce a new audit of the CARES Act Provider Relief Fund that will work to examine the effectiveness of HHS's controls over awarding the payments, and looking at data and interviewing program officials to gain an understanding of their basis of calculation and review those payments for compliance within the CARES Act.
So is that the same OIG audit authority that's referred to in the law, where sometime in, is it a 3-year horizon that
Yeah,
audits begin to
originally within the terms of, and Harvey might want to talk a little to this, but originally on the, in the terms and conditions, it talks about, you know, the OIG, you know, has the authority to go in and audit how you spend your money. This is with respect to OIG announcing that they're looking to make sure that HHS had effective controls in place when they went to calculate the funds that were distributed to providers. So a whole different ball game.
Oh, I see. Right.
Yeah, because the OIG
of HHS.
Yeah, the OIG is an inspector general, and as an inspector general, which has been getting a lot of publicity lately, inspectors general of agencies, one of their primary jobs is to see whether the agency for which they are the inspector general is doing its job properly.
Right. So, okay, OIG will be scrutinizing both HHS and its administration of this program, as well as the individual.
Correct.
The individual recipients. And perhaps with that, we should move on to talking about the reporting and auditing as they're talked about in the terms for these programs. So I understand the CARES Act required providers receiving money under the relief fund to submit quarterly reporting. What do we know about this? What will be required? When will the reports be due?
Well, they defined the first one to be due July 10th. We do not know what that report will look like. There's no guidance that has been issued yet. So considering how many other deadlines have been extended, I think people are keeping their fingers crossed that this will be extended too. But right now, that's all we know, due July 10th. And we don't know what those reports look like, but those reports will be required to report all stimulus money, any funding you receive from any act that related to COVID. And then it will also ask for you to submit how you spent that money or how it might have subsidized lost revenues.
Interesting. And who's reviewing the reports and where are they submitted? Is this all going through HRSA?
They will be submitted to HHS, but everyone pretty much between HHS, HRSA, OIG. Harvey might want to talk a little bit about that in terms of who has the ability to look at these to make sure that and review them. To make sure they've followed the terms and conditions. I mean, the terms and conditions specifically state in it who all has access to audit these.
Yeah, I think you're going to see audits, quite frankly, from all those agencies, SBA, OIG, HRSA, CMS, HHS, contractors. There's going to be a lot of folks doing auditing. It would appear to me Congress didn't give out all this money and not want to have some accountability for how it's being spent. So you're going to be seeing a lot of folks doing auditing, and exactly how that's going to be done, how that's going to be coordinated, I think is something that we're going to learn about in the future.
Yes. And Harvey, is there any... is there a minimum threshold of dollars providers must have received in order to be subject to the auditing?
Well, you definitely will be audited if you receive more than $2 million. But that doesn't mean that if you receive less than $2 million that you won't be audited. But obviously, they're going to audit those that got the most money first. And then they'll sort of work their way down. But that can change if there are complaints. We think that given the nature of this program, you're going to see the key Tom Barr, the attorneys that represent whistleblowers. I think you're going to see a lot of activity in that area. You're going to see a lot of complaints potentially, a lot of whistleblowers, and all of those can redirect the attention of the government agencies to respond to those. So right now it's a little bit on the auditing side, a kind of the wild, wild west. We really don't know, but we are confident there will be audits, and who will be doing them, how they will be done, and when they will be done is still to be determined.
Right.
Suzanne, there's been a lot of numbers thrown out in terms of thresholds. Just a couple of things that I might point out. The quarterly report is required to be filed if you've received over
$150,000. Okay.
Single audit will be required if you have received over $750,000. And then with respect to the PPP loans, they have identified that if you've received over $2 million, you will be audited.
I see. Okay, that is a lot of different thresholds. And as so often with audits, it takes so long to settle out, right? it may be the receipt of the money may be significantly in the rearview mirror before providers learn about the audit. So I guess that just underlines the importance of the contemporaneous documentation of how they have used the funds. And
that is exactly right. I mean, I could not stress enough how important it is for them to be tracking that now, because so much of the expense and realignment of the resources you had took place in March and April, and they really got to focus on going back to that and accumulating that information.
Right, which when you think about real-time crisis response administration of a facility during those months, and then also taking the care to go back and account for the use of those funds, that's a pretty hefty lift, it would seem. I think we have just a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you all one other question. Curious how you advise, if you have encountered this situation, long-term care facilities that are navigating changes in ownership during this time. If provider relief fund money is based on the billings in a prior year, then what happens when a facility is sold or merged into another entity? Is that something you've seen coming up?
We have, and there have been a number of frequently asked questions that have dealt with that. For example, on May 20th of this year, question number two under the frequently asked questions was the following. An organization that sold part of its practice, this is obviously not a long-term care facility, this was a physician group, in 2019 or January 2020 received a payment under the general distribution that reflected the 2019 Medicare fee-for-service billing of that part of the practice. Can it return a portion of the payment for part of the practice it no longer owns? And HHS responded by saying no, it may not return a partial payment. And then it went on to say that within the context of a provider that sold part of the practice, and I'll quote, if a provider anticipates that its COVID-related lost revenues of increased expenses will be materially less than the value of the provider relief fund payment received, the provider should reject the entire general distribution payment and submit the appropriate revenue documentation through the general distribution portal to facilitate HHS determining the correct payment, end of quote. So what HHS seems to be saying is that even if a provider sold a substantial part of its business, in the case of a long-term care facility, probably be the entire facility, that in part justified the amount of the fund that it got, that is the timing of the sale, if it was in business for part of the sale, that doesn't necessarily create an overpayment if the provider believes that its healthcare related expenses and lost revenue will not be materially less. So the payment amount itself does not appear to be material. Instead, the material components are the provider's ultimate healthcare expenses and the lost revenue attributable to COVID. And if the provider believes there will be materially less because of the sale, then the entire payment should be returned. And this was reinforced by another question in that frequently asked questions, which was question number three. It was the following question. That question was, does HHS intend to recoup any payments made to providers not tied to specific claims for reimbursement, such as a general distribution payment? And the response was that the provider relief fund and terms and conditions require the recipients to be able to demonstrate that lost revenues and increased expenses attributable to COVID-19, excluding expenses and losses that have been reimbursed from other sources, or other sources are obligated to reimburse, exceed total payments from the relief fund, then generally HHS doesn't intend to recoup as long as the provider's lost revenue and increased expenses exceed the amount of the provider relief funding a provider has received. So that's something that has to be looked at. And we expect there will be additional frequently asked questions on this particular subject. Yes. So it's sort of a stay tuned, if you will.
Right.
What is also complicated is, and this is somewhat peculiar to long-term care facilities because of the delays that occur when a long-term care facility is sold, the buyer sometimes isn't able to bill immediately, but they actually have taken over the operation of the facility, so they bill under the prior providers, the selling providers, Medicare number. In those kinds of situations, you certainly can't keep the money for the period that's covered by that because you weren't providing the services as the selling provider. In those cases, you need to return all the money. And then the buyer can make application if it feels it's entitled to the money and if it experienced COVID-related expenses as we've been describing them.
Right. Okay. So if the buyer didn't bill Medicare in 2019, then clearly it wouldn't be entitled to any funds under that general distribution.
Correct.
And that seems to dovetail in with the topic we were discussing earlier about actions to take when providers think that the distribution they received might not have been correct or excessive. Well, certainly, there are a lot of weeds here. We've gotten a little into the weeds. I feel like we've given a bit of an overview of the high points as well in terms of what the money is for and what the safeguards are on it. Harvey, Camille, do you have any other last thoughts on the Provider Relief Fund before we sign off?
Well, let me just say that I think it should be obvious that you have to have a system in place to adequately document how you're spending these funds, from what fund you're spending them and what you're spending them on. And if you haven't taken time to do that on your own, certainly consulting with folks like Camille at BKD would be very helpful to get an idea of how to create that kind of an accounting system to be able to keep track of this. Because when you're audited, I can assure you the auditors will be looking for that kind of detail.
Well, thank you both. Thank you, Camille. Thank you, Harvey. This has been really for me and I hope for our listeners as well.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity.
Fun.
We appreciate it.